This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. For the last 6 months, a group of 29 people from around the state have been meeting to figure out ways of improving the economic standing of young women and girls in Vermont. Earlier this week, the group, called the Task Force on Young Women and the Vermont Economy, held a press conference in Montpelier. Linda Tarwielen is the chair of that task force.
We were last here together almost exactly 6 months ago when there was a press conference that talked about a report called Enough Said, which was a very stunning and exciting report, but it was really something that was depressing as well, because it was the results of a survey and interviews and research that Vermont Works for Women did to see how things were for young women in this state. And they found there were some real problems that needed to be addressed.
Some of those problems that need to be addressed include the fact that women, regardless of age and educational levels, are nearly twice as likely as men to live in poverty. Nearly half of female high school dropouts in Vermont will be persistently unemployed as adults, compared to a quarter of male dropouts. The report also identified barriers to success for young women, including a lack of practical economic skills and limited exposure to work options and role models. This week, the task force came up with some recommendations to address the concerns about young women and girls in Vermont's economy, and we're going to explore them today, as well as what policy initiatives might help. Tiffany Bloomley is the executive director of Vermont Works for Women. She's also a member of the task force. Welcome to the program, Tiffany.
Thanks for having me.
And Stephanie Seguino is a professor of economics at the University of Vermont. Professor Seguino, it's nice to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me, too.
Tiffany Bloomley, you originally formed this task force. Vermont Works for Women formed it after doing a survey report that we mentioned called Enough Said that looked at some of the challenges for girls and young women in Vermont's economy. And a lot of them were surveys or listening sessions. What did that report actually reveal to you?
Well, we hosted the listening sessions because we wanted to tailor programming for older girls to the particular needs of young women, funded by the Women's Fund. We conducted 9 listening sessions around the state. And what we heard were really around 3 major themes. One, they said, I don't know how to make decisions about money. I don't know enough about debt. I don't know how to make decisions about taking on college debt. I filled out my taxes and I didn't know what I was doing. So that was one. Secondly, they said, how do I know that I want to be an automotive mechanic if I have never held a socket wrench? And so they talked about their lack of exposure. And then third, they talked about the fact that they really didn't have strong relationships with their friends. And I really struggled with how to understand those comments. But it was in every single listening session, regardless of the fact, we didn't ask a single question about that. And the link is that girls were telling us really 2 things. One, that there was a lot of peer aggression that then affected the goals that they set for themselves and the risks that they took.
When they said they didn't have strong relationships with their friends, were they talking about other girls or just in general?
Yes, primarily. They were talking about aggressive behavior among girls.
Some of those don't seem necessarily gendered. You know, if you asked young boys, do you feel like you have financial literacy or do you feel like you know what you want to do? Do you have experience being a mechanic? Boys might say the same things. Was this
Absolutely.
Designed to separate the genders or you're just focusing on women because that's your priority?
What we do. Well, that's where our expertise lies. And the funding came from the Vermont Women's Fund. And their interest is in girls 15 to 25 and helping them to become more financially self-sufficient. But you're absolutely right. There are themes that came up in these listening sessions that boys would have brought up as well. But the fact is that where financial literacy is concerned, for example, because women live longer, because of the wage gap, they bank less money in Social Security. They're more likely to live in poverty. As elders, the financial decisions that they make at a very young age are critical to how they will live out their lives.
So, Stephanie Seguino, as someone who studies the economy and economics, does this paint a familiar picture to you?
Yes, right. This is very reflective of conditions across the United States in terms of gender inequality in participation in the labor force and in wage outcomes and so forth.
So why do you think, Professor Seguino, that women are falling behind in Vermont and elsewhere?
Well, first of all, I want to say that I really appreciated the study. I thought it was a very interesting look from the perspective of these young women, and I think it helps us understand what people-based policies can help change women's economic opportunities. There are a lot of structural factors that even more education or more role models can't overcome on their own. One of the things that we find, for example, is that people, for men and women with a high school education, men earn 30% more than women. But even when you move up the educational rank, if we look at men and women with a master's, men earn 35% more than women. So educational differences aren't the explanatory factor. And there are unconscious and subtle biases in the workplace. And I think one that we haven't focused on enough is the role of family responsibility and single parents. One of the things that I think is a critical factor in women's weaker economic opportunities is that they bear disproportionate responsibility for children. And we don't have policies that support work-family balance.
We're talking today about women and girls in the workplace. And listeners, I'd love for you to jump in on what Professor Seguino is saying here and what we've been hearing from Tiffany Bloomley about some of the barriers to access for women and what you think would actually work. What would help? What would be a good solution? What are you doing in your community or your school or your workplace? Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. To what Professor Seguino was saying, we got a note from the Lund Family Center, who wrote in to say the lack of affordable quality childcare is a very serious issue for young mothers. Without a safe and loving place to leave their children for fees that are within the budget of women on reach up or working minimum wage jobs, it's economically disadvantageous for some women to work. The same is true of secure, affordable housing. There's a serious lack of subsidized and low-income housing in Vermont. So, Tiffany Bloomley, how do you address issues like that? That's very sort of policy-oriented, and a lot of what you looked at was less policy, less legislative, and more what people can do in their own workplaces or in their own communities. But how do you address something like what the Lund Center is saying?
That's a very big question, and
welcome to Vermont Edition.
Yeah, we weren't trying to write a comprehensive report on the status of women and girls in the state of Vermont. What we did want to do is convey what girls recognize themselves about the things that limit them. And in 2013, we shouldn't have been hearing these things. And the fact that we are one of about five nations in the world that don't have guaranteed sick time for workers is another contributing factor to add to what Professor Seguino said. I think that there are a lot of things that there are policies, indeed, that can change work-family balance for families. It'll make a difference for men and women and their children. That said, there are also, we focused on things that, many things we could do individually to make a difference that will, I think, hopefully create a political climate that can lead to some of those changes. But we are focused in part on a cultural shift in changing attitudes, opening eyes so that more of us, you and I and the lady down the street and the firefighter and the Burlington, all are thinking about how well we are preparing young women for what's a very big world. And in a state like Vermont, where so many are growing up in rural communities, what you know is what you think about. And as President Obama said, I think last week, you can't be what you can't see. And so I don't think that addressing that improving the status of women and girls, the economic status of women and girls, will happen through legislation alone, through public policy alone, and the political will for that has to come, at any rate, from you and I and others who say, it's 2013, let's change it.
So give me an example of some of the recommendations that you do make.
Sure. Well, for one, for boys and girls, we need to be more attentive to their financial literacy. So, and that means perhaps not expecting them to take that as an elective, but requiring that it be incorporated into the coursework. We're also, the Vermont State Colleges have pledged to sponsor a statewide conference on, among other things, the relational aggression that often erodes confidence and aspiration for so many girls, as they explained it to us, and equips adults to better contend with that when it arises. Yes, there's bullying at schools, and boys are equally victims. It's expressed somewhat differently among boys or between boys and girls, and oftentimes the peer aggression that girls exhibit is subtler. It's often not recognized by adults, or it's dismissed by them as something that, well, that's being a teenage girl. And that's not acceptable. We need to have better tools as adults to confront it and avoid it altogether. And a lot of people who work with young people have said, I'm not quite sure how to deal with this. Social media has only made it worse in recent years.
So, Stephanie Seguino, how do you see this? I mean, this issue of a need for policy changes. We were talking to you about that. We heard from the Lund Center about that. And then sort of a concurrent cultural shift. You know, how do you see those playing together and working together?
First of all, if I could comment on the peer aggression
Absolutely.
Issue, I think it's a very interesting one. There's a term that's sometimes used called the power dead even rule. And it's the expectation amongst women that power will be kept flat or shared. So when some women are bumped up or promoted, for example, typically women try to begin to bring that person down. And, you know, so there's gender norms in place, but I think the dynamic amongst young women in particular is that women's sense of self-worth is often related to, you know, they're enculturated for to be related to their attractiveness, and in particular their attractiveness to men. And in a society in which men are more likely to have economic security and higher social status, women then find themselves competing in that realm. And I think that's only going to change if women define their self-worth in terms of their own accomplishments. And in that sense, we do lack good role models for women. And when we look in Vermont state government, U.S. government, even the University of Vermont administration, for example, leadership positions tend to be dominated by men. And so when women have aspirations for themselves and define their self-worth in terms of those self-achievements, I think competition amongst girls will decrease. So I think it's changing the culture, but there are structural problems that have to be addressed as well. And if I might add, there's, you know, another structural problem, of course, is the economic one, and that is that the quality of jobs that are available for men and women is declining. And it is typically women who end up getting minimum wage jobs, for example. So the response to this then needs to be comprehensive, right? There can't be a silver bullet that's going to address this. And so, for example, higher minimum wages, paid sick days, work-family balance policies are all part of changing the structure in which women tend to do the unpaid work and have a poor economic status. That's the overall problem, and it requires multiple policies and endeavors to change that.
We're talking a little bit about what that might take in Vermont today, and listeners, you can share your thoughts with us by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We actually put up one of the 15 suggestions for personal action that came out of this task force on our Facebook page and asked people to comment. The suggestion we put up says, specifically invite a girl to help you change a tire, fix a leaking pipe, or update a program on your computer. Some of you wrote with suggestions of your own. Randy says, first of all, specifically try to inform them that men were not placed here on earth to support them. And Annie said a twist on that would be specifically inform boys that women were not put on earth to work, raise kids, clean house, cook meals, and serve their husbands, looking at cultural shifts there. Paul was critical of that recommendation in the first place, writing, "That's a silly recommendation. Specifically invite a girl to do three things that nobody likes to do." Although I think Tiffany Bloomley might disagree that yeah. nobody likes to change a tire or fix a pipe. And then we had people who were writing about other suggestions. Elizabeth said, let a girl run the tractor or the baler, shovel the roof, split stovewood. Let her know that she can be physically strong without needing to be on a sports team. Diane says, tell her she doesn't need to be an airline stewardess. She can be a pilot. Doesn't need to be a waitress. She can open a restaurant. And she doesn't need to do the roles of women before her, but think outside the box. So add your own suggestions on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Tiffany Bloomley is the executive director of Vermont Works for Women. Stephanie Seguino is a professor of economics at the University of Vermont. And they are both with us today talking about barriers to success for women in the economy and what Vermont can do to address these concerns. Governor Shumlin held a news conference and press event this week to highlight the need for change. And we're hearing from some of you about your experiences and what you think about changes to support women in the workforce and beyond. You can call 1-800-639-2211 with your thoughts or post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Barb says, I would very much like negotiation skills taught along with financial skills. Too many women and young women are willing to accept lower wages without even exploring a higher entering wage. Negotiation is a skill that will last their working life. And let's go to Donna calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Donna. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question, or maybe more of a comment. Since so many women who are professionals and, you know, either starting a family or as you age in the workforce, you know, you find yourself without a job and starting your own company. And in Vermont in particular, I think, is sort of going after a lot of self-employed people for payment of things like unemployment compensation for sole contractors, workman's comp, and there's actually a property tax issue, too, for people who pay their own for their own retirement funds. You know, that there's an awful lot of ways that self-employed people and self-employed women like myself are being subjected to additional taxation over what people who are work in lower paid jobs for businesses.
And so Donna, you see that as an issue for women more so than for men?
Well, I think it's an issue for, I think women find themselves in this position more than men, partly because of the family raising issues, but also, you know, just sort of the little bit of discrimination you get in the workplace where women tend to find themselves out of jobs, particularly in professional jobs.
Is that something you've experienced yourself, Donna?
Oh, yes.
How do you recognize it, that you're being discriminated against, and you think maybe because of your gender?
It's kind of subtle. It's kind of subtle, but, you know, if you want to stay in your line of work here, and particularly because mine is sort of engineering and architectural-related work, I couldn't find another job in this state. If I had been a man, I probably could have gone to work for an engineering firm, but they don't recognize that what I do, which is a little bit more design-oriented, that there's a value to that. So, you know, I had to kind of I had to create my own niche here, you know, in order to have a job here, because otherwise I would have had to move.
Yeah, Donna, that's an interesting point to pick up on. Tiffany Bloomley, what about that sort of subtle discrimination or that idea that maybe women have a harder time in getting into certain jobs, especially jobs and fields where there aren't a lot of women already there?
Well, I think that that's very much part of the reason that, say, only 7% of working civil engineers are women. 3% of Fortune 500 CEOs are women. Only 14% of their boards are women. I think that white shoe organizations like the Wall Street Journal and McKinsey and Company have written a report on this, and they talk about the importance of a dramatic systemic organizational change that in fact companies that really want to achieve diversity are going to have to do more than follow the cheerleading of a CEO for whom that is important. The effort has to be sustained. It has to be very deliberate. We have to be in it for the long haul.
Professor Seguino, would you like to pick up on that as well?
And I concur with Tiffany. I mean, the data are quite clear that there are these gender imbalances in these particular occupations. And, you know, the challenge for us is to understand the ways in which this happens, at what point during the hiring process, and where are the biases showing up and so forth. I think that there's sometimes a perception that women don't want to enter these professions, but with the rise in single-parent households and simply women's desire to be economically viable, there's a lot of evidence that women do want to move into these kinds of positions and face barriers because of gender norms and stereotypes. And that's a collective problem we face with regard to men entering so-called female occupations as well. And I think it is something that I find that if we can put it on the table and let the light of day shine on it and have discussions about it, we can begin to unravel the subtle and unconscious ways that result in these barriers.
While we're having this conversation, let's get a little bit of data specifically on Vermont and Vermont jobs. On the line with us now is Annie Noonan, who is commissioner of the Department of Labor. Commissioner Noonan, nice to have you on the show.
Thanks so much, Jane. Appreciate it.
Do you know if there's a wage disparity in Vermont between men and women?
There is. I mean, I think that the national numbers will show that Vermont does a little bit better in that regard. The pay inequity nationally between women and men is 78%, and in Vermont it's 84%. But that's still a significant number.
In other words, women earn 84% of what men do.
That's correct. That is correct. Women are in the workforce in Vermont almost as equally as men. They're in the workforce at 48.5% of all Vermont workers are women. And 40% of women are bringing home, particularly women in mothers, are bringing home the majority of family income. And that's a national statistic. So, you know, this is not women are not in the workforce to earn, you know, the old saying, pin money. They are actually, in many cases, a significant number of the times, the majority of the family income is coming from their salary.
So what you're finding is that women, though, are earning somewhat less than men and increasingly are the main wage earners. What does that mean for families?
Well, I think it's important that we prepare ourselves as women in the workforce and for women entering the workforce to move towards the careers not only that pay better, but also where there are openings. And in Vermont, when we look at the statistics and we break things down by, you know, education level versus the growing occupation in for people with that degree, we can find, for example, that people with high school, people coming in with a high school education should be moving towards the building trades, all building trades, whether it's construction, electrical, carpeting, carpenters, because that is, we really have an aging workforce in Vermont. That is, so that lines up very well, and those are jobs that people don't need advanced degrees for. They can move into those, and for example, you know, going to be a bricklayer, stonemason, or a carpenter in Vermont, a pipe fitter will pay very well comparatively. In addition, we see occupations in law enforcement and in supervisory positions and in some sales. So those would be good positions for people with high school degrees. Manufacturing in Vermont, which is not, you know, people don't think of us as having a strong manufacturing base, but we do. And those are also better paying jobs in Vermont. When you move into having an associate's degree, you're really looking at nursing and engineering and construction again, and some specialized healthcare fields. If you become a rad tech or a phlebotomist or something like that, you're going to do well. And when you look at what is opened up for people with associate's degree, in Vermont it's medical and engineering and dental. And then moving up the line for folks that are basically with bachelor's degrees, the fields that are where we see open for in Vermont will be for financial advisors, all sorts of software designers, IT administrators, security people, systems developers, and engineers, and also the financial end with basically people who can do management analysts for finances and things like that. So we really, you know, what we're looking at, you hear a lot about the whole issue of moving women towards STEM occupations. It's that's true, and but it's really sort of moving them towards specific STEM, you know, whether it's IT, finance, engineering, accounting, healthcare. Those are very critical. But there's also opportunity for people in public relations and human resource development and sales. It's just you really have to get line those up with the companies that are growing in Vermont.
And Commissioner Noonan, do you see from your position as the commissioner of the Department of Labor a possibility to move public policy in any specific direction? Are you advocating for any bills this upcoming session?
Well, I think a big step forward was the pay equity bill that passed last year. I think that's very important. The Department of Labor supported that and testified for that. And I think that that was an important step forward to try to reduce that. I also think that there's a family leave bill pending this year, and I think that that will be an important step to try to ensure that women who often fall behind on wage earnings as a result of family responsibilities, and it's sometimes at both ends of their career, at the child care age, you know, when they're raising their family, and then often they have great responsibility in terms of elder care, you know, sort of the parents taking care of their parents, that they come in at sometimes are that requires them in and out of the workforce, or they are coming in and out of the workforce, and they fall behind in terms of their wage earnings. So I think that bills that promote sort of stable wage earnings, allow people to have the leave time that they need for the responsibilities of family, will help women very dramatically.
That's Annie Noonan. She's the commissioner of the Department of Labor. Thank you very much for speaking with us, Commissioner.
You are welcome.
We're talking here about barriers that women face and challenges that women face. And you look at the lineup here on the show. I'm a host. I'm a host of this show. I'm a woman. We have Tiffany Bloomley. She's the head of Vermont Works for Women. Stephanie Seguino, you're a professor of economics at the University of Vermont. Annie Noonan is a commissioner in a state department. She's a woman. You know, you could say, look, there are a lot of women who are doing really well and succeeding. So, Stephanie Seguino, how do you combat that idea? We've got some on our Facebook page who say, is this really still an issue?
Well, that's a good question. I think, you know, we have to acknowledge the progress that has been made. What has happened, however, is that progress has stalled. So if you look at the U.S., for example, the wage gap between full-time male and female workers has stagnated since 2001. If you look at female labor force participation rates, they have also stagnated. And much of this data really underestimates the economic gap between men and women, because the data that I was just referring to, and Commissioner Noonan, I believe, was referring to full-time workers. And, of course, women have disproportionate care burden that's unpaid, and so the actual economic gap between men and women is much wider than that. So, in fact, we have a long ways to go. We still see women not being able to enter occupations or get the promotions that would be commensurate with their skills and their interests.
And Tiffany Bloomley, do you see this mainly then as a question of poverty? You know, that women who live in poverty or grow up in poverty have fewer choices than women who perhaps don't, and that if we address that, that we're really going to get to the problem of gender inequality.
Well, I mean, certainly that is very important, and it's a big part of our work. That said, the young women with whom we conducted listening sessions came from families of very different means, and there are too many young women who have had a lot of encouragement in their lives who still limit themselves in important ways, and there are still barriers to advancement that are subtle, perhaps forms of discrimination that we have got to become more aware of.
Well, we have links to the task force's recommendations, both recommendations that are sort of statewide and personal things the task force recommends that you can do with the young girls and young women in your life. You can find those at vpr.net. Stephanie Seguino, professor of economics at the University of Vermont, thank you very much for talking with us today. Appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. pleasure.
And Tiffany Bloomley, Executive Director of Vermont Works for Women and on the Task Force on Young Women in the Vermont Economy, thanks very much to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Before we go, I want to correct a statement we made during yesterday's Vermont edition when we discussed reactions to the decision to base the F-35 fighter jets in Vermont. Winooski Mayor Mike O'Brien is not asking for the decision to be reversed. Rather, Mayor O'Brien tells VPR, quote, "I have and will continue to work with the Guard to address concerns about the basing. The planes are coming, so let's work together to mitigate the noise." Coming up, a Rockwell painting sets a record, selling for more than $46 million at Sotheby's yesterday. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Yesterday at Sotheby's Auction House in New York City, the sale of a group of paintings by Norman Rockwell made headlines. One painting, titled Saying Grace, fetched more than $46 million, setting a record for the sale of a painting by an American artist. That painting and two others that were sold in yesterday's auction had been on loan to the Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge, Massachusetts for many years. Joining me now is Stephanie Plunkett, the museum's curator. Stephanie, nice to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, Saying Grace, that one that sold for $46 million plus, was expected to sell for $15 to $20 million, which, you know, in and of itself is a lot of money. It sold to an anonymous buyer for three times that. And you were there. So first of all, tell us about the atmosphere in Manhattan.
Well, you know, it was obviously very exciting. There were a lot of people in the room and the floor and at Sotheby's. I think waiting for the painting to come up. It was number 10. And, of course, there were people in private viewing rooms also that were looking down on the action. And most of the bidding, well, all the bidding for this particular work was done by phone. So we, of course, couldn't see exactly who was bidding on the pieces, but there was certainly a lot of lively activity. I think it was, you know, something like 9 minutes or so of back and forth. And it did come down, it appears anyway, to two bidders who were on the phone and you know, bidding on the painting right up until the end.
Were you surprised that it went for so much money?
Well, I know this is going to sound crazy, but I'm not terribly surprised. And that is because it's an extraordinary and singular work. It's really a Rockwell icon that in some ways reflects his incredible mastery. I mean, I think everything that he had learned and done in his career really came together in this work. So in some ways, it's a painting that reflects the very best of a wonderful artist.
Can you describe it for people who aren't familiar with that title? Saying Grace is one of his more famous paintings, but describe the scene.
Certainly. It was actually a cover illustration for the Saturday Evening Post, which, of course, was a very popular magazine. It was done for the November 24th, 1951 issue, and it was a Thanksgiving cover. So, of course, as a cover artist, he constantly had to come up with different ways of interpreting the same subject, particularly around the holidays. And in this case, he shows a rather crowded railroad diner, and it's so crowded that people who don't know each other are actually seated at the same table, which would not have been too unusual at that time, perhaps. We see an older woman and a young boy with their heads bowed in prayer. And, of course, the interesting thing is the reactions of the people in the room to that action. So we see at the same table two young boys who were looking on rather curiously. One of them was actually modeled by the artist's son, Jarvis Rockwell. And in the corner, there's an older gentleman who's looking on with great reverence. Down at the bottom, there's a man smoking a cigar and having his breakfast, and he is very cropped out of the picture, but he's looking on with a little bit of surprise. And, of course, then there are those people who aren't paying attention at all. There's a gentleman literally moving out of the picture, and we don't see him. We just basically see his elbow. But it's a beautiful, cluttered but very organized scene. In some ways, I think it epitomizes Rockwell's ideal artwork, which he said was always filled with humor and pathos. So you have a little bit of both sides of feeling in this work.
And
really
you're able to describe this so well, Stephanie, partly because you've probably seen a lot of it. Saying Grace and two of the other paintings that were sold yesterday, Gossips and Walking to Church, had for a long time been on loan to the museum. They're now sold. Is there any chance the museum might still be able to get them back at some point?
Well, you know, we always we're very fortunate in that people who have owned Rockwells in the past certainly have on occasion placed them on loan to us. And in addition, we've been lucky because we've had some wonderful donations of Rockwell paintings. So we always say we never know, you know. An artwork goes out into the world. I have to say I'm personally going to miss them tremendously, but I do hope someday we will get to exhibit them again.
You might have to find out who actually bought the paintings first, though. This
exactly.
Anonymous bidder, any chance we might find out who it is?
You know, that's a tough one. Unless someone really wants to reveal themselves as the owner, it's sometimes difficult to find out who owns an actual artwork. But eventually, we do sometimes have ways of finding out, and sometimes people want to reveal themselves. They want to share the work and by placing it on loan. So we hope that's going to be what happens.
So you're going to keep your ear to the ground.
You bet.
Stephanie Plunkett is Deputy Director and Chief Curator at the Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. She was at yesterday's art auction in Manhattan, where a group of Norman Rockwell paintings sold for nearly $58 million combined. Stephanie, thanks for telling us a little bit about it today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, a few weeks ago, speaking about Norman Rockwell, we interviewed art critic Deborah Solomon about her new biography of the artist called American Mirror, The Life and Art of Norman Rockwell. The painter's family had cooperated with Solomon in her research for the book, but have been critical of some of the writer's conclusions about Rockwell's life. One serious point of contention is Rockwell's sexuality. Here's a clip from our interview with Solomon.
I don't want to call him gay. Some people have said to me, why don't you just call him gay? And I said, because that's just a label. It doesn't mean anything. And I just kind of lay out all the evidence, and I will let readers draw their own conclusions. But I think he really did yearn for the company of men and not women. And I don't really see a need to put a label on that.
Well, label or not, Solomon does imply that Rockwell may have had intimate feelings for men, possibly even for young boys, though she points out that there is no evidence he ever acted on these feelings. This week, the Norman Rockwell Family Agency released a statement about Solomon's book, claiming she presents a fictionalized and misconstrued portrait of Rockwell. The statement reads in part, "Ms. Solomon's conclusions demand scrutiny. The family now feels that her purpose in befriending us and writing this fictionalized account was publicity, financial gain, and self-aggrandizement. We cannot allow totally unsupported allegations about Norman Rockwell with no supporting factual backup to live into perpetuity without correcting the record. We have no wish to interfere with Ms. Solomon's free speech right, but we must exercise our own to note that she has exercised her right irresponsibly." You can listen back to our interview and read the Rockwell family's full statement online at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. And that's going to wrap up today's show. Tomorrow, we'll follow up on the problems facing the state's healthcare exchange. Last week, some business leaders called for a one-year delay in implementing it, while the state continues to fix the online payment process. Two officials in charge of the exchange will be Bob Kinzel's guests. Should the state hit the pause button on the healthcare exchange? Email your thoughts to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Tim Johnson. Neil Charnoff directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.